And good afternoon. You're listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show. Coming to you from our studios right here in exciting El Paso, Texas. Gateway to the Old West and the most haunted city in the country. Well, before I get started, I want to take a minute to talk about scams. Now, I've talked about it before, but today I got 11 emails from everybody you ever heard of except President Trump telling me my fund was available to be picked up. I just had to send this particular individual all my personal data to confirm I was me, and I'd get anywhere from $2 million up to $20 million. I've heard from the head of the FBI, the CIA, Nancy Pelosi's office, you name it, I've heard from them confirming me it's real. And I don't know if I've talked about this, but I knew a guy in England, in London, when what's known as the Nigerian Prince scam first got rolling. And he had been promised $75 million if he would pay $15,000 in cost, I think. And he was a very intelligent man. He was in the financial field. He took a second mortgage on his house and flew to Nigeria. When he hit the airport there, he was arrested and thrown in jail. It cost him $30,000-$40,000 in legal fees to get out. And the Nigerian prince that was to be waiting for him at the airport, nobody ever heard of. So when somebody promises you something, all you got to do is pay a fee. I knew somebody who got an email from the IRS. Now, the IRS does not send emails, but they owed $2,500 in taxes, and they had taken out a warrant for his arrest. Now, he could pay it right then by clicking 1 on his phone. So an individual came on and said, okay, we're going to make it easy for you. Go down to Walmart and buy $1,500 of gift cards. We're going to give you a discount. You owe $2,500, but we're going to take $1,500. So you go to Walmart, you get these cards, you call us back, and you give us the number on the cards. Well, needless to say, they were not IRS agents. He lost his $1,500 plus the cost of the cards. And they laughed all the way to the bank, I would imagine. Well, all that having been said, today is December 14th, 348th day of the year, and leap year is 349. 17 days remain till this year's over with. On this day in history, in 557 AD, Constantinople's damaged by an earthquake, severely damaged, I might add. In 835, the Sweet Dew incident, Emperor Wenzong of the Tang Dynasty conspires to kill the powerful eunuchs of the Tang court. But unfortunately, even the emperor wasn't powerful enough to get that done. The plot is discovered. 1287, St. Lucia's flood. The Zuider Zee seawall in the Netherlands collapses. Over 50,000 people are killed in the ensuing flood. Where was the kid to stick his finger in the dike? All right, 1542. Princess Mary Stuart becomes the Queen of Scots at the age of 1 week when her father, James V of Scotland, dies. 1751. The Theresian Military Academy is founded in Wiener Neustadt, Austria. 1780, Founding Father Alexander Hamilton marries Elizabeth Schuyler Hamilton at the Schuyler Mansion in Albany, New York. 1782, the Montgolfier brothers test fly an unmanned hot air balloon in France. It floats almost a mile, 1.2 miles. 1812, the French invasion of Russia comes to an end as the remnants of the Grand Army are expelled from Russia. They're actually beaten by the weather. 1814, War of 1812, the Royal Navy seizes control of Lake Bourne in Louisiana. 1819, Alabama becomes the 22nd U.S. state. 1836, the Toledo War unofficially ends. Now, for those that have never heard of the Toledo War, it's known as the Great Toledo War, the Michigan-Ohio War, or the Ohio-Michigan War, an almost bloodless boundary dispute between the U.S. states of Ohio and the adjoining territory of Michigan. Now, there wasn't much understanding of the Great Lakes, and that produced conflicting state and federal legislation between 1787 and 1805. And various interpretations of the laws led the governments of Ohio and Michigan to both claim jurisdiction over a 468 square mile region known as the Toledo Strip. Well, when Michigan petitioned for statehood in 1835 and sought to include the disputed territory in its boundaries, that brought the situation to a head, and it had to be dealt with. Ohio gained control of the Toledo Strip. Michigan gained the entire Upper Peninsula. So both sides, in effect, won, though there wasn't a great deal at stake, actually. 1863, American Civil War. The Confederate victory under James Longstreet at the Battle of Bean Station in East Tennessee ends the Knoxville campaign. But it achieved very little as Longstreet pulled out of Tennessee and went back to Virginia in the spring. 1896, the Glasgow Underground Railway is opened by the Glasgow District Subway Company. That's in Scotland, don't you know? 1900, quantum mechanics. Max Planck presents a theoretical derivation of his black body radiation law. 1902, Commercial Pacific Cable Company lays the first Pacific telegraph cable from San Francisco to Honolulu. 1903, the Wright brothers make their first attempt to fly with the Wright Flyer at Kitty Hawk, North Carolina. 1907, the Thomas W. Lawson, the largest ever ship without a heat engine, that runs aground in Founders near the Hellweather Reef within the Isles of Sicily during a gale. The pilot of the ship and 15 crewmen die. 1909, New South Wales Premier Charles Wade signs the Seat of Government Surrender Act, 1909, formally completing the transfer of the state land to the Commonwealth to create the Australian Capital Territory. 1911, Roland Amundsen's team, which included himself, Olav Badelin, Helmer Hansen, Sverrir Hassel, and Oscar Wisting, become the first to reach the South Pole. 1913, Haruna, the fourth and last Congo-class ship, launches, eventually becoming one of the Japanese workhorses during World War I and World War II. Now, the Congo-class ship was a class of four battle cruisers built for the Imperial Japanese Navy right before World War I. Actually designed by a British naval architect, the lead ship of the class, the Congo, was the last Japanese capital ship constructed outside Japan. It was built by Vickers at Bower and Furness. The three sister ships, the Haruna, the Kirishima, and the Hai, were all completed in Japan. But they were rather powerful ships. They were 27,384 tons displacement. Had 36 boilers. Speed was 27.5 knots, which was about 31 to 32 miles an hour. It had a crew of 1,193. It could steam 8,000 miles at 14 knots. It had, it was known as the fast battleship. And it carried three float planes on board that were launched by catapult. So all in all, it was a hell of a weapon. All right, 1914, Lisandro. Let's try that one more time. 1914, Lisandro de la Torre and others found the Democratic Progressive Party at the Hotel Savoy in Buenos Aires, Argentina. 1918, Frederick Carl von Hessen, a German prince elected by the Parliament of Finland to become King Vanel I, renounces the Finnish throne. You can't even give some people things. 1918, Portuguese President Sidonia Pais is assassinated. 1918 United Kingdom general election occurs. And this is the first election in the UK where women are permitted to vote. 1939, the Winter War. Soviet Union's expelled from the League of Nations for invading Finland. 1940, plutonium is first isolated at Berkeley, California. And the place has gone to hell ever since. 1948, Thomas Goldsmith Jr. and Estelle Ray Mine are granted a patent for their cathode ray tube amusement device, the earliest known interactive electronic game. 1955, Albania, Austria, Bulgaria, Cambodia, Ceylon, Finland, Hungary, Ireland, Italy, Jordan, Laos, Libya, Nepal, Portugal, Romania, and Spain join the United Nations through the United Nations Security Council Resolution 109. 1958, the third Soviet Antarctic expedition becomes the first to reach the southern pole of inaccessibility. 1960, Convention Against Discrimination in Education of UNESCO is adopted. 1962, NASA's Mariner 2 becomes the first spacecraft to fly by Venus that we know of. 1963, the dam containing the Baldwin Hills Reservoir burst. Kills five people, damages hundreds of homes in Los Angeles, California. 1964, American Civil Rights Movement. Heart of Atlanta Motel versus the United States. Supreme Court of the United States rules that Congress can use the Constitution's Commerce Clause to fight discrimination. 1971, Bangladesh Liberation War. Over 200 of East Pakistan's intellectuals are executed by the Pakistan Army and their local allies. It's called the Martyred Intellectuals Day in Bangladesh. 1972, Apollo program. Eugene Cernan is the last person to walk on the moon after he and Harrison Smith complete the third and final extra-vehicle activity of the Apollo 17 mission. Now, there are rumors there were two other moon missions after this, but NASA's always refused to discuss it. 1981, Arab-Israeli conflict. Israel's Knesset ratifies the Golan Heights Law, extends Israeli law to the Golan Heights. 1985, Wilmer Mankella takes office as the first woman elected to serve as the principal chief of the Cherokee Nation. 1992, Warren Abkhazia, the siege of Tverceli, a helicopter carrying evacuees from Tverceli shot down, resulting in at least 52 deaths, 25 of whom were said to be children. The incident catalyzes more concerted Russian military intervention on behalf of Abkhazia. 1994, construction begins on the Three Gorges Dam on the Yangtze River in China. 1995, Yugoslav War. The Dayton Agreement signed in Paris by the leaders of the Federal Republic of Yugoslavia, Croatia, and Bosnia and Herzegovina. 1998, Yugoslav War. Yugoslav Army ambushes a group of Kosovo Liberation Army fighters attempting to smuggle weapons from Albania to Kosovo. 36 people are killed. 1999, torrential rains cause flash floods in Vargas, Venezuela. Tens of thousands of people die. There is also the destruction of thousands of homes and the complete collapse of the state's infrastructure. 2003, Pakistani President Pervez Musharraf narrowly escapes an assassination attempt. 2004, the Melulu Viaduct, the tallest bridge in the world, is formally inaugurated near Melulu, France. 2008, Mantahar al-Zaidi throws his shoes at the then U.S. President George W. Bush during a press conference in Baghdad, Iraq. Now, in Iraq, that was considered a great insult. 2012, Sandy Hook Elementary School shooting. 28 people, including the gunman, are killed in Sandy Hook, Connecticut. 2013, reported coup attempt in South Sudan leads to continued fighting and hundreds of casualties. And 2017, Walt Disney Company announces it would acquire 21st Century Fox, including the 20th Century Fox movie studio, for $52.4 billion. Must be nice to have that kind of money. All right. A lot of births and deaths on this date in history. Holidays and observances, Christian Feast Day, Falkwin, John of the Cross, John III of the Cedre, in the Syriac Orthodox Church, Matronian, Nicasius of Reims, Nimotula Kassab in the Maronite Church, Spyridon in the Western Church, Venantius Fortunatus, Alabama Day in Alabama, 47 Ronin Remembrance Day in Tokyo, Martyred Intellectuals Day in Bangladesh, and Monkey Day. And I guess that's when everybody just kind of monkeys around. All right, let's see what else we got. Okay, Tycho Brahe, the Danish astronomer, was born on this date. Peter O'Toole, who captivated audiences with performances that showed his versatility in roles ranging from classical drama to contemporary farce during a 70-year stage and screen career, died in London on this date in 2013. George VI, who became King of the United Kingdom on December 11, 1936, when his brother abdicated, was born on this date in 1895. And George Washington, the first President of the United States, died at Mount Vernon in Virginia on this date. Nostradamus, one of the great seers of history, was born on this date in 1503. Okay. Okay, we'll see. Well, okay, and 644. Uthman ibn Affan, companion of Muhammad, appointed third caliph of Islam. In 867, Adrian II begins his reign as Catholic pope. 872, John VIII elected as Catholic pope. 1124, Theobald Bucephalus was elected pope under the name of Calistinus II. He refused the honor. 1600, Oliver Van Noort sinks a Spanish galleon in San Diego in the Bay of Manila. 350 die. 1774, on this date, you had the first incident of the American Revolution. 400 New Hampshire militiamen successfully attack Fort William and Mary. And finally, in 1812, I talked about the Russian invasion of the French invasion of Russia. Ended on this date. Well, the French lost as many as 530,000 people, but they finally threw in the towel and gave it up. Okay. We've been talking about Ghost of the South. Now, iron magnate Elias Baker, who was known to history as a very wealthy individual, built his dream home in Altoona, Pennsylvania. It took 4 years to build. And in 1849, he moved his wife and three children into this Greek Revival-style mansion. It was considered to have been built out in the wilderness. Two of the children, Sylvester and Anna, never married and stayed in the house until they both died. Now, while Sylvester clearly wanted to live a solitary life, his sister Anna, according to legend, desperately wanted to get married. According to the story, shortly after moving into the house, she met an iron worker in the area. They fell in love and became engaged, but her father refused to let her marry someone of a lower socioeconomic class. Well, she begged and pleaded, even bought a wedding dress, hoping her father would change his mind, but he was known to be obstinate and domineering and bullheaded, and he brought Anna suitor after suitor, men he felt were actually worthy to be in his family. But she refused to even talk to all of them, growing angrier as time went on. Kept her wedding dress all the years of her life. Sometimes servants would see her wearing it and dancing in the moonlight by herself. Well, the Baker Mansion became a museum run by the Blair County Historical Society, and that dress was put on display. And people have seen it move and sway as if dancing on its own, and others have seen it shake violently as if enraged. Many visitors claim when they peer into that glass case to look at the dress, a woman's face would be looking back at them. And others have reported they've seen a woman dancing in a wedding dress in different places in the house. Well, eventually the museum took the dress off display. They said its exposure to light and pollutants was causing it to deteriorate too much, but there are others that say it was done because there were too many reports of Anna being seen in her dress. Then we have the Bassano vase. Now, proving that looks can be deceiving, this seemingly innocuous silver vase is said to be one of the most cursed objects in the world. It brings death to each and every one of its owners. Now, according to the tale, it was made in the 15th century for a bride-to-be and was given to her as a gift the night before her wedding. But before she could get to the altar, she was murdered. Supposedly, she was holding that vase in her hands when she was killed. As other members of the family took possession of the vase, which was a beautiful work of art, they died as well. And then it vanished. According to many stories, the family hid it away. In 1988, it surfaced again with a note of warning that said, "Beware, this vase brings death." But in spite of that, it was put up for auction. And it was reported that the note conveniently vanished. Well, the pharmacist who bought the vase at auction died within months. And the vase was then purchased by a surgeon. Now, both the pharmacist and the surgeon were in perfect health when they bought the vase. Well, the surgeon died within 2 months. The next cursed owner was apparently an archaeologist, and so it went until eventually either the police confiscated the vase or a terrified family member insisted the police take it. Either way, the vase was then reportedly put in a lead box and buried in an undisclosed location. And since that time, there have been no additional deaths associated with it. Now, it's bad enough when private homes have their share of ghosts. But what happens when the location is a hotel? I mean, there's no question the anonymity and transience of hotels can serve as the perfect cover for twisted minds to act out their most heinous fantasies, and these monstrous acts can leave their mark long after the events themselves are over with. And frankly, haunted hotels do dot the American landscape, with tales of spirits of guests and workers and owners who never fully checked out, but continue to reside in those locations. Let's start out talking about H.H. Holmes' murder castle. It looked innocent enough from the outside. Now, H.H. Holmes wrote a memoir. It's called Holmes' Own Story. It lets the alleged multi-murderer and arch-conspirator tells of the 22 tragic deaths and disappearances in which he's said to be implicated. Now, he wrote this while he was waiting to go to trial. And there are those who say that, in fact, he may well have been Jack the Ripper. There are rumors that say that he was in Whitechapel during the 1988 reign of terror caused by Jack the Ripper. The best evidence for that? Handwriting experts who compared Holmes' handwriting to a letter thought to have been written by the Ripper, they've concluded they were written by the same person. So was H.H. Holmes Jack the Ripper? Well, he was never convicted as such. Now, he was also the first documented serial killer in American history. He was actually born Herman Webster Mudgett in 1861. Had an interest in medicine as a child, and is said to perform surgeries on animals under that pretext. At 18, he went to medical school, where he used cadavers to run an insurance scam. He married and had one son during this time period, but he abandoned his family in order to roam about the country, trying out different frauds and swindles. When he showed up in Chicago in 1885, he was going by the name of H.H. Holmes, and was a well-practiced con artist. In this bustling city, he was able to run several scams on credit, always paying off only what he had to while scheming to get money elsewhere. Began working in a drugstore, which he eventually took over after driving out the previous owner. It's believed that he did that through a shifty con. In 1892, on the corner opposite the store, he began building what became known as the Murder Castle. He claimed it was a hotel that would serve as lodging for the massive influx of tourists that were coming to the World's Fair that was going to be held the next year. And he did lure a lot of lodgers there, many of whom were young women. Some of them were his mistresses, and most of those young women never left the hotel alive. Or dead either, for that matter. The construction went in fits and starts, with Holmes hiring and firing workers and contractors. And what seemed to be a whim. Nobody worked on the building from start to finish, so nobody knew all the horrors that Holmes had planned for the inside that building. According to legend, the ground floor had shops and the third floor had apartments, but the second floor and the basement were nothing short of torture chambers. Along with nearly 100 rooms, there were walls on hinges that swung open and closed, stairs that led nowhere, trap doors, secret passageways with peepholes in the rooms, and a chute that led to the basement. And there was an alarm system installed to alert Holmes and people he had imprisoned tried to leave. One room was lined with asbestos and had nothing in it but gas fixtures. It became known as the asphyxiation chamber. And that wasn't even the worst. The true horrors were in the basement. There were surgical tools, operating tables, strange devices that looked like torture racks, pits of acid and quicklime, and a crematorium to dispose of bodies. Nobody really knows for sure how many people are killed at Murder Castle. One story says as few as 9, others say as many as 200. And the torture and terror they underwent is something that is just very difficult to imagine. Shortly after the affair ended, Holmes moved on to Chicago before his creditors could catch up with him. He continued his crime spree as he traveled east. He was arrested in November of 1894 for insurance fraud involving a corpse, which was an old trick from his college days. And while in custody, he began to tell his convoluted story and was tried and convicted for just one murder, his business partner. But he ultimately confessed to 27 murders. 1895, the Murder Castle caught fire and burned to the ground. There are those that believe Holmes ordered it to be done. Great way to hide evidence. In 1896, he was executed. Now, outside Chicago, Holmes had access to the furnace of a glass-bending factory, which is large enough to cremate several bodies at one time. In fact, it's there that Holmes may have disposed of the bodies of his mistress, Minnie Williams, and a number of others. The voices of men conspiring have been heard in a corner of the furnace room. More commonly, though, an apparition of a woman in black has been seen staggering around on the property. And a lot of people believe it is the spirit of Minnie Williams. Now, there are a few stories more terrifying than that of Holmes. He was actually, by any definition, a true monster. Little wonder it's why they believe his victims linger where the infamous Murder Castle once stood. Now, today a post office stands in its partial footprint, including part of what may have been the original basement. And it's there that the spirits of the victims and even that of Holmes himself seem to remain. Employees often refuse to go down there as people have seen the concrete walls and halls shifting. They felt the presence of multiple entities, and they've even heard their voices. Some people who've had experiences with the spirits of Holmes victims, like Custodian Royal Hood, feel the ghosts make themselves known so people are uncover the grisly circumstances of their death. According to Hood, they want their stories told, and I think it's working. Well, from the Murder Castle, let's turn to the Stanley Hotel, which was made famous. In 1909, a grand 142-room Colorado Colonial Revival-style hotel opened in Estes Valley in Colorado with telephones and electricity and in-suite bathrooms. Stanley Hotel was cutting edge for the time. It was built, after all, by the wealthy inventor and entrepreneur Freeland Stanley after he came to the valley on his doctor's orders. The pristine environs did wonders for his consumption. That's also known as tuberculosis, by the way. He liked it so much he decided he didn't want to leave, and a lot of folks believe he never did. His ghost has been reported enjoying itself in the lobby as well as in the billiards room. His wife, Flora, can still be heard tinkling the ivories at a hotel's piano. One of the original housekeepers hired at the Stanley was in a terrible explosion in room 217. And though she did survive her injuries, her spirit is said to roam the rooms trying to continue to tend to the needs of the guest. Now, I said it became famous. It was the hotel used in Stephen King's The Shining when they made the movie. The Stanley enjoyed an opulent heyday before it began to deteriorate. And by the 1970s, its luster and exclusivity was gone. And that's when author Stephen King had a stay there that he'd never forget. It was the night before the hotel was to close for the winter, and he and his wife were the only guests in the building. Remember, 142 rooms. The cavernous, empty quarters struck the writer as the perfect backdrop for a ghost story. That night, King dreamed that his son, who was just 3 at the time, was running terrified through the halls being chased by a fire hose. He woke up sweating, and in the time it took him to smoke a cigarette, he had outlined The Shining. And what room did he stay in? Number 217, of course. Now, when the exterior shots of the hotel and Stanley Kubrick's version of The Shining were of the Timberline Lodge in Oregon, the 1997 TV adaptation of the novel was filmed on location at the Stanley. It's thought the latter was created in part because King didn't think Kubrick's version captured the essence of the story and wanted a film version that was closer to his original story. So why not go to the source itself? You know, while staying at the Stanley, Henley Yao captured an image of a semi-transparent woman at the top of the main staircase quite by accident. The image went viral in 2016, and Yao says, what I experienced during my visit made me realize there's so much we don't know, and we should remain open to all possibilities and may question our beliefs with skepticism. Now, though King is probably the most famous guest to have an unsettling night stay, he's not the only one. Throughout the hotel, a lot of folks have experienced the lights going on and off on their own, heard the disembodied laughter of children, seen the imprints of bodies lying on their beds. The man who once owned the land the hotel's built on, not to mention the local brothel at the time the hotel opened, was the womanizing Lord Dunraven. Now, he said the lingered rooms 401 and 407. He sneaks up on guests, flicks the lights, and looks out the windows. He'll even breathe down the neck of female guests and sometimes grab them by the arm around the waist, particularly when they're alone in the guest room closet. Also rumors that a homeless woman died in the music room and can be heard screaming when her story is told. A woman in room 412 allegedly became possessed during her stay. And, you know, the paranormal stories told by guests and employees go on and on. Apparently, very few people are untouched by the hotel's strong paranormal presence. Well, let's turn to Eureka Springs, Arkansas, which is an interesting place. In 1886, the Crescent Hotel opened as an upscale resort in Eureka Springs. Its construction had been a massively expensive undertaking, accomplished at a feverish pace. During the building, an Irish stonemason allegedly died when he fell through an unfinished floor. But in spite of that, the work continued. Now, Eureka Springs was a popular destination at the time. Its namesake waters are said to have curative powers. But as that proved to be untrue, the patronage of the town and the Crescent dwindled. At the turn of the century, the hotel opened during the off-season as the Crescent College and Conservatory for Young Women. And for a number of years, it did attract young women. Now, but then that also began to dry up. Now, the Crescent struggled, opening and closing, until 1937 when the infamous inventor, swindler, and self-styled Dr. Norman Baker turned the Crescent Hotel into a health resort. He called it the Baker's Cancer Curing Hospital. Now, he claimed to have the cure for a whole host of ailments, cancer among them. And he revived the rumors that the springs had healing powers, and he did indeed attract sick and desperate people from across the country. He may not have cured what ailed them, but he certainly took their money. He put on a show of treating patients without actually providing any genuine medical care. Paranoid, he installed bulletproof glass in his office at the hospital. And by the time he was arrested for fraud, he had bilked his despairing, dying patients of over $5 million. Now, today, that would probably be $25 million. Now, Norman Baker was certainly a showman, but it was also a fraudster and a torturer. He had an extensive history in vaudeville, radio, and scams. But when you look at behind the showman, he had absolutely no medical training at all. When he owned a radio station, he ranted and raved against organized medicine on air, calling it a corrupt business that wanted to make money more than it wanted to help people. And ironically, that's exactly what he wanted to do himself, though he positioned himself as the savior of the common man. Before he owned the Crescent Hotel and created his hospital, he had a traveling show in which he pretended to cure a man of brain cancer. even had another hospital in Muscatine, Iowa. And his first so-called miracle cure was nothing more than the watermelon seeds, corn silk, alcohol, and other utterly useless ingredients he would inject into his patients, giving them nothing but false hope and pain. At the same time, he bilked them of every penny they had. Well, after he was arrested for fraud, the hotel saw a multitude of owners and restoration projects. In 1997, Mary and Elise Rugink bought it, and they were fully restored it to its former glory, making it a popular destination once again. Part of the reason it became such a alluring destination were the fact that it was considered one of the most haunted hotels in the country. Now, the ghost of the Irish stonemason, whose name was Michael, made his presence known in room 2018, where he turns the lights on and off and pounds on the walls, even reaches out of the bathroom mirror. There's a gentleman in Victorian garb who's been seen hanging around the lobby, the bar, and even some of the rooms watching people sleep. Sometimes he'll slam the doors or even shake a guest awake. People have also seen a nurse pursing a gurney carrying a corpse down hallways. Usually this hallway is the one that leads to where the morgue used to be, and then she'll vanish into thin air. Another ghost, calling herself Theodora, tells people she's there receiving treatment for her cancer, and then she'll vanish. She's also been known to tidy up her old room, which was room 419, and even pack up for guests staying there. Dr. Ellis, one of the also of the hospital years, appears dressed very dapperly, as they used to say, near the elevators. You can sometimes smell this pipe smoke. And, of course, there's the spirit of Norman Baker himself. He's always seen wearing the white suit with the lavender shirt and tie he was so fond of in life. Well, from hotels, let's turn to, well, let's call them murder houses. There's some houses that have seen things that no home ever should. Once peaceful domiciles have been turned into slaughterhouses where unspeakable acts of evil were carried out by strangers, by loved ones, or by unknown entities. Victims of such extreme and unexpected acts of violence are believed to have a hard time moving on from this world. They get trapped in the places where their fates played out, and quite often they have to reenact them again and again and again. One of those I'm referring to was the house Sharon Tate lived and died in. Now, the murders of Sharon Tate, who was just a couple of weeks away from having a baby with her husband, Roman Polanski, she was murdered. Wojciech Prakowski, a screenwriter, Jay Sebring, a Hollywood hairstylist, Abigail Folger, heiress to the Folger Coffee Empire, and Stephen Parent, a young man who was visiting the house to see its caretaker, were murdered in such gruesome and brutal fashion that that it shocked even the seasoned homicide detectives who arrived at the scene. And this sense of horror would sweep the nation as the details of the murders kept playing out on national TV. Charles Manson was a cult leader of a family of followers who believed he was Christ, and as a result, they would carry out any orders he gave them, no matter how grisly or insane they might sound. On August 8, 1969, he told one of his followers, a young man named Charles Tex Watson, to go to a house on CeeLo Drive in Los Angeles and destroy everybody in it, as gruesome as you can. And that's exactly what Watson did. Fellow murderer Susan Atkins said she killed Tate. She said, "We wanted to do a crime that would shock the world, that the world would have to stand up and take notice of, and that's what we did." Well, with him, Watson took followers Atkins, Patricia Krenwinkel, and Linda Kasabian. Manson told the women to do as Watson told them, and they didn't disobey. They got at the house after midnight, but once on the property, they encountered Stephen Parent. Watson slashed and shot and killed Parent for being in the wrong place at the wrong time. sent Kasabian to keep a lookout at the state's gate in the one of the house where with Atkins and Kasabian. Once they got in the house, they made the four people stay in there, Tate, Sebring, Folger, and Frykowski, together in the living room. They tied Tate and Sebring together by the neck. Sebring protested about being treated so roughly, and the fact that Tate was pregnant and they were treating her terribly. And for this, he was immediately shot to death. Folger and Frykowski tried to escape, but both were caught. Frykowski was beaten, shot, and stabbed while Folger was stabbed and to death. Frykowski's autopsy revealed 51 stab wounds. Folger had 28. Tate, who was pregnant, begged for the life of her baby, asking to be taken hostage so she could deliver. But the deranged murderers wouldn't have any of it, though, and she was stabbed 16 times. At some point, Kasabian, after hearing the terrified, agonizing screams coming from the house, came to the group and tried to cut the murder short by telling him somebody was coming. But it didn't work. After everybody was dead, the word pig was smeared on the front door of the house in Tate's blood. Following night, another group of Manson's followers continued their murderous spree, killing grocery store executive Leno LaBianca and his wife Rosemary. Well, Manson and his cult of followers were arrested in October. And once they were caught, their belief that Manson was Christ apparently came to a screeching halt. Kasabian exchanged her testimony for immunity. But Manson, Atkins, Watkins, and Krenwinkel were all convicted and given death sentences. 1972, California, being the land of fruits and nuts, banned the death penalty, and their sentences all commuted to life in prison instead of death. Since the night of those events, committed by some of the most infamous killers America's ever known, the house where Sharon Tate and company were killed has been torn down. Then a new one was built in its place. The current owner, David Oman, swears that Tate and some of the other victims are unable to move on from their tragic, grisly ends. Even before the house was completed, the construction workers heard disembodied voices and footsteps and felt chilled air blowing down their necks. Once the house was completed, Oman began having its own paranormal experiences. He woke up to a full-body apparition standing at the foot of his bed, gesturing toward the driveway. When he later saw a picture of Sebring, he recognized him as the man that he had seen appear at the foot of his bed. Objects move and fall over their own accord. Once, blood-red stains appeared on a woman's dress without any apparent cause. Oman has even heard Tate whisper to him, "I just want you to know we're still here." Well, it's interesting to note that these were relatively same people who came to believe Charles Manson was, in fact, Jesus Christ, and they had to obey him. And there's a number of reasons that have been put forward over the years as to why Manson ordered the murders. One of which was that he was a wannabe music guru, and one of the people who used to live in the house where Sharon Tate was living had promised to help him get a recording contract, but he didn't, so Manson sent his killers to kill the individual he thought lived there. In fact, they found Sharon Tate and company. Now, from Los Angeles, one case that I've talked about several times is the Villasca axe murder. Now, Villasca, Iowa, is a sleepy town where everybody knew everybody and hardly anybody locked their doors at night. So when the Moore family and their two guests were viciously murdered with an axe by an unknown assailant, it shook the town to its core. Now, this bizarre, brutal mass killing started not long after midnight, June 10th, 1912. when somebody walked in the back door of the Moore home carrying an axe. Now, the axe belonged to Joe Moore, who was the father, and the killer likely found it in the yard, probably by the woodpile. And by the low light of an oil lamp, this individual crept past the room where two little girls, Lena and Ina Stillinger, were sleeping. They were staying as house guests. They presumed the killer was male, but nobody really knows. But whoever the killer was, they climbed the stairs and went into the bedroom of Mr. and Mrs. Moore, raising the axe over his head so high it scraped the ceiling. He brought it the flat side down on Joe's head. It's believed Joe died immediately. Killer then hit Sarah, like before she was even fully awake to know what was going on. And then the killer went into the other upstairs bedroom where the four more children, Herman, who was 11, Mary Catherine, 10, Boyd, 7, and Paul, 5, slept. And he apparently acted silently because there was no sign of struggle from any of those children. Seems as though he was able to kill each child without waking any of the others, which was hard to believe. Then he went downstairs and killed the two little girls who were staying over as house guest. Though the killings were done, the murderer wouldn't. Went back to each and every victim and beat them in the head so ferociously with the axe that none of their faces were recognizable. And then he covered their heads with sheets or clothing. Went around the house covering up all the mirrors. He filled a bowl with water and washed his hands. Then he vanished, never to be seen. It's believed he probably got on a freight train. Now, today the Villisca axe murder house is known to be heavily haunted. It's been restored to exactly how it was that night in 1912, and you can tour the house, and frankly, for a fee, you can even stay overnight. Martha Lynn, the current owner of the house, says that guests report they play with the children, they hear voices, and they get pictures of anomalies. In 2014, one guest suffered a self-inflicted stab wound to the chest while he was alone in one of the upstairs bedrooms shortly after midnight, which was the time of the alleged time of the murders. Mist had been recorded on night vision cameras. Things move on their own. Disembodied screams ring out, and flashlights apparently turn on and off if you ask the ghost to prove they're there. So much paranormal activity reported by so many, it's easy to see why this house does have a worldwide reputation for being haunted. Now, the Villisca murder spree has gone unresolved, largely thanks to the curiosity of the townsfolk themselves. After the bodies were discovered, the people of Villisca were, of course, horrified, but dozens of them swarmed through the house, taking in the grisly scene. Some even took fragments of the skull from Joe's brutalized remains as a sort of ghoulish token of the event. And needless to say, any evidence that may have pointed to the killer was obliterated by the snooping hands and tramping feet that passed through the Moore house that day. And though many suspects have been named, nobody has ever tried, much less convicted for this crime, making it one of the most infamous unsolved murders in American history. Now, of course, one of the most famous haunted houses is Lizzie Borden's house. Now, statistics say that murders are most likely to take place in the home committed by somebody you know. And that seems to be true in the case of Lizzie Borden, who was accused of hacking her father, Andrew, and her stepmother, Abby, to death with an axe. According to the story, and I'm sure we've all heard it, Lizzie Borden took an axe and gave her mother 40 whacks, and when she saw what she had done, she gave her father 41. Everybody knows it. What's less commonly known is that Lizzie was tried and acquitted of the crime. And even in spite of this acquittal, the townspeople didn't think she was innocent. And ever since these murders that took place in August of 1892, history has Lizzie Borden down as a brood of murderers. Now, Lizzie was 32 and still living at home at the time of the murders. Didn't much like her stepmother, and her father was apparently very stingy, despite the fact he had great wealth. He'd recently given one of his rental properties to Abby instead of Lizzie and her sister Emma, and there were rumors he was going to cut his daughter's inheritance in favor of Abby. So greed is often put forth as the reason for the murder. And they, a lot of people still believe Lizzie did it, even though the court found her innocent. There's also a wealth of circumstantial evidence that points to her. For instance, she tried to buy poison from a pharmacist the day before the murders, and though he wouldn't sell it to everybody in the Borden household had been vomiting in the week leading up to the violence. Abby had been suspected it was poison and had gone to the doctor for help. On August 4th, Andrew went to work. The maid, Bridget, was outside washing the windows, and Lizzie was in the house along with her stepmother. That's when she allegedly took a hatchet. It wasn't, in fact, an axe. It was a hatchet. And gave her stepmother 19 whacks. Not quite the 40, the rhyme claims. It was still a heinous and mutilating amount of violence that rendered Abby's face unrecognizable. When Andrew returned, Lizzie said that Abby was out visiting a sick neighbor, trying to get Bridget to go run an errand, but the maid went to her room in the attic instead. Andrew laid down on the couch for a rest, and in 10 or so minutes that Bridget was upstairs, Andrew got 10 blows from a hatchet. Lizzie called for Bridget, claiming she had been in the loft of the barn and returned to find her father's body. It wasn't until a neighbor and a doctor arrived that Abby's body was discovered on the second floor of the house. Well, nothing in the house was out of order, aside from the bodies and the copious amounts of blood splattered on the walls and even on the ceiling. Later checks showed nothing was stolen and there was no signs of forced entry to the house, which was always kept securely locked, including all the outside doors and the doors of each room inside. It would seem that Abby at least knew the murderer and the murderer knew the house. One question about the murders, Lizzie kept getting her story garbled. Now, when she was home when Abby was hacked to death, she apparently didn't notice it happening. She thought Abby was out on an errand and apparently didn't hear a thing, not even the body hitting the floor. And there are no footprints in the thick dust of the barn loft, and when police investigated it on the day of the murder, a few days after the murders, a neighbor saw Lizzie burning a dress that she said was stained from paint. And then there's her icy silence during the trial. The house where all this happened still stands on 2nd Street in Fall River, Massachusetts. Liz even returned to it after her trial and lived there with her sister for a while. It's B&B today, partly because it's said to be haunted by the ghost of that hot, violent day over 100 years ago. Anybody who wants to can stay in the room where Lizzie lived and slept, and sleep in the room where Abby was hacked to death, and lounge in the living room where Andrew met his end at the blade of a hatchet. The owner, Leanne Wilbur, has heard floors and empty rooms creaking, seen doors opening and closing on their own, caught whiffs of flowers when there are none present, and once saw a strange shadow walk up the stairs before every bulb in the chandelier casting that shadow blew out at once. According to Wilbur, she said, I said to nobody in particular, you went tonight and went out and slept in my car. Guests have also been known to flee in the night. Apparitions of Lizzie, Abby, Andrew, Bridget, and even Bridget's cat, rumored to have been found decapitated in the basement shortly before the murders, have all been seen or heard, all making this murder house one for the history books. You know, even though there was a lot of circumstantial evidence that pointed to Lizzie Borden, she was acquitted. The court couldn't believe such a sweet-looking Christian woman was capable of such brutality. Also, holes in the prosecution's story that the jury believed cast a reasonable doubt on Lizzie's guilt. For instance, why wasn't she covered in blood when she went to tell Bridget her father had been murdered just minutes after it must have happened? And where was the murder weapon? It was not found. Couldn't her silence in court be a result of shock or the morphine a doctor gave her to keep her calm? And there'd been workers in the loft of the barn days before the murder, and their tracks weren't visible there either. One of the pieces of evidence against her was the fact that even though she said she'd been in the barn loft, her fingerprints couldn't be found. And there was no actual evidence of poison that led to everybody's illness. Might have just been some bad fish she'd eaten, according to the doctor whom Abby had seen. And couldn't the murderer have been somebody known to the family and angered by some stingy slight from Andrew? Well, they never came up with a reason for the murders. And we've run out of time for today's show. We'll be back tomorrow. And once again, you'll be listening to Ken Hudnall and the Ken Hudnall Show. And we'll be talking about more Ghost of History. Till then, have a great evening.